You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
I'm Heidi Salo. I'm with DLA Piper, and I am moderating today's session called Privacy on the Go. And I have with me four very esteemed panelists. I will start. I'm not probably going to go in order here, but I will start with Anne Toth. Well, maybe I will. Anne Toth, on the end, who is the Vice President of Policy and the Head of Privacy for Yahoo. She's been at Yahoo for more than 10 years, where she's managed a wide array of policy issues related to privacy, user-generated content, child safety, advertising standards, online accessibility, and direct marketing. Anne is also on the board of directors for the Network Advertising Initiative. Next to Anne, we have Brian Knapp, who is the chief operating officer at Looped, a mobile geosocial networking company. In addition to executing the day-to-day company operations and activities, Brian oversees data privacy and security, corporate development, and legal affairs for the company. Brian also serves on the board of the Family Online Safety Institute, in addition to a number of other things. I have to condense all the bios today. I've been told to keep it short and sweet. So next to Brian, I have Lori Craner, who is an associate professor of computer science and engineering and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. She's also the director of the Sci-Lab Usable Privacy and Security Lab and Laboratory, and chief scientist at Wombat Security Technologies. She has written over 80 research papers on online privacy and related cyberspace and cybersecurity topics. And then last but not least, next to me I have Alyssa Cooper, who is chief computer scientist at Center for Democracy and Technology. Her work there focuses on a number of issues, including consumer privacy, net neutrality, and technical standards. And she currently co-chairs the Geographic Location Privacy Working Group within the Internet Engineering Task Force. So welcome to our panelists. Okay, so today we have about 55 minutes, not a ton of time. We're going to cover actually a lot of topics, so we'll try to just touch on some of these topics and provide a really interesting discussion for you today. We're going to start by talking about mobile advertising, and then we're going to segue into location-based services and the privacy issues that are associated with location-based services. And then we're going to wrap it up by talking about social networking, and in particular in the mobile environment. So we'll start with mobile advertising, which, as you probably know, these days includes more than just the on-device type advertising, like clickable ads, graphical banner ads, video clips, and even traditional TV commercials that you can view on your mobile device. It also includes things like a call to action, through an MMS or SMS or WAP push. Does everyone know what that means when I say that? Everyone? Okay, so like a text message, basically. So a call to action asking you as a user to respond to the call to action using text messaging, or pushing out a text message or a WAP ad to you on your mobile device. So these days, mobile advertising really runs the gamut, from everything that we can think of in the traditional online environment, but also these new technologies. So I'm going to start by asking Anne to talk a bit about the debate and the discussion surrounding mobile advertising and where it exists today in terms of the prevalence of mobile advertising in today's world.
Thank you. So I feel like I've been talking about mobile advertising for a long time. Every year is the year that mobile is going to be huge. Every year has been the year for the past, 7 or 8 years. I think the first time I was on a mobile privacy panel was in 2004, and we were talking about the difficulties of providing privacy notices, and we're talking about the growth in the marketplace. And in a lot of ways, we're now at that real tipping point, I think, where for years we've been waiting for that moment. With the prevalence of smartphones, with the advent of the iPhone, with applications, with larger screens, with more capability, more memory, we're really kind of at that place now where I think all the things we've been talking about as being possible are really actually possible. A lot of the types of advertising that you talked about, while they're possible, they're not commonplace yet. So I want to put it a little bit in context, and Brian may need to check me on my numbers here because he's actually a legitimate business person, and I'm more of a policy person. So I'm the person in the company who's always telling the business people this, that, or the other about regulatory and policy constraints. So they would argue that I'm limiting their upside potential, whereas Brian over here is making it all happen for Looped. But in the mobile marketplace, it's important to remember that it's a small marketplace. It's really quite embryonic in the U.S. in particular. So in the U.S. alone, 65 million people access the mobile internet monthly. 58 million U.S. mobile subscribers have seen an ad on their mobile devices sometime in the past 30 days. But this is only 23% of all U.S. mobile subscribers. Internet mobile usage in 2008, it grew 40% in 1 year alone. So we're seeing incredible growth potential, and the numbers do seem on their face quite large. Yahoo is fortunate to be a leader in the mobile internet. We have 33.3 million unique users per month on our U.S. mobile sites. We lead overall in terms of reach, email usage, messenger usage, and in news readership. But to think about all of this, you need to put it in the context, of course, of the dollars. So in 2008, nearly $650 million was spent on mobile advertising in the U.S., and only part of this was on display advertising. As you mentioned, there are various forms of advertising. Video is up and coming. Display is up and coming. Areas like SMS may be pretty well saturated, but we're going to see a lot of growth in the display advertising market in particular. But by 2013, in just 5 years, it's expected or projected that mobile advertising is going to grow from $650 million to over $3.3 billion. So it's not a surprise that there's a lot of interest in this area. And those numbers seem really, really big. $3.3 billion seems really, really big. But when you think about online advertising today, it's over $30 billion in the marketplace on online advertising today, and it's continuing to grow, and it represents only a small, small, small fraction of all advertising dollars that are spent. So you put into context, mobile advertising is still just a very nascent industry. It's a very, very small proportion of all advertising that we see. When you consider the global marketplace, however, the numbers do get bigger. In many parts of the world, users, their primary means of accessing the internet is through their mobile device. So the numbers are larger than just the U.S. marketplace, but I think everyone would agree that it's still relatively small. Philosophically speaking, at Yahoo, we show ads on our mobile devices that are similar to what we show on the PC in terms of trying to tailor the ads to the most relevant user experience that we can. So if you're typing in a search term, you're going to get a search result and a sponsored result that's going to be relevant to the search term that you typed. We're going to try to show ads based on where you are and what your observed interests are. I think most mobile users would prefer that they don't just get ads for ringtones all the time. So we're trying to fulfill that marketplace. But relevance is probably more important in the mobile environment than it is in the regular PC-based internet experience because space is so limited. And users, are often frustrated that it takes a long time to navigate the mobile web. To get a page loaded takes a great deal of time. Inventory is quite constrained. We limit ourselves to one advertisement per mobile page. On any other page that you see on the internet, you're going to see a lot more in the way of advertising than you're going to see in the mobile experience. So we think it's even more important to drive relevance in the mobile environment than perhaps anywhere else.
Well, too, that's interesting that you say that. I have read, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, that in terms of global advertising spend, that mm-hmm. even globally, mobile advertising is only about 1%. Again, I don't know how accurate that is, but even if it's a little off, it's still mm-hmm. pretty small.
Yeah.
You're making a good point about the effectiveness of the ads, and I know that's something that mobile advertisers are dealing with now is, that's obviously the small screen size, as you mm-hmm. mentioned, creates, issues for advertisers, and, they certainly don't want to deliver ads that are not attractive or, going to take people to their sites, for example, if it's a banner ad. So I know that's something that they're dealing with now. We won't get into behavioral advertising yet. We'll get into it a little bit later. For now, we'll just kind of talk generally about mobile advertising. I know that's another hot topic. But I'm going to now turn it over to Brian to talk about specifically about Looped. And if Brian, if you could just give everybody like a one, minute description about Looped and how it works, and then tell us how you generate revenue from mobile advertising.
Sure. I was testifying on the Hill this morning, and Alyssa reminded me about how I was forced to give yes or no answers, so it'll be such a pleasure if you don't cut me off, but if you have to. I did get away with a maybe.
Yeah, I did.
I explained it was my first hearing, so. Looped is about finding the things around you, and relevance is a big word that we use in the office, as Anne just brought up, and location is the essence of mobility. It's what makes these devices different from, larger PC computers, most televisions, et cetera, right? And so people are on the go as the panel goes, and, they want to know what's happening around them, and that's what we're trying to give them, is the most relevant information. Where are their friends and family? What are the cool restaurants and things happening around them, the events, and all in that sort of social, mobile, local context. So I have, probably most folks can't see it, but, you can go to our website and check it out. And, of course, if you have an iPhone or a BlackBerry, or if you're an AT&T user, Sprint Nextel, Verizon, you can download the application, and we're always looking for more users. So, but basically it's about, this interactive map that uses location technologies to locate you and your friends and family that have opted in to share their location with you. We're big proponents and big believers in the potential of mobile advertising. That's what we expect to be our primary revenue and monetization opportunity going forward. Again, I'll come back to that relevance and the opportunity there to have ads that are targeted by location and time of day, maybe have to do with what your friends also like or certain demographic information. And the great thing about Looped and being sort of a first-party server of those advertisers is that we can act as a proxy between advertisers and agencies and our users. And we think that's a really key aspect of our business and doing this well from a privacy perspective. So in other words, we don't have to give individual locations identified to certain users to advertisers or agencies to deliver their ads. We can take care of that because we're already handling that information for our customers. But advertisers also win because the ads are so relevant. And, of course, if a user chooses to click on them or chooses to redeem a coupon, then the advertiser can have a direct relationship with that user going forward. So we think there's a big opportunity here. We also agree that it's currently a small market. Certainly the form factor is a challenge, but for us it's also an opportunity because the know-how we feel that we have in the building for creating applications and delivering content into this environment. And we also feel like it's going to go way beyond banner advertising, and you'll have streams of data and information that really provide value, and users may see those more, frankly, as content than advertisements.
Okay, great. And we'll just confirm quickly, and then I want to turn it over to Alyssa. I guess I mentioned this, and it's a good segue. What you just said is a good segue. This whole issue of behavioral advertising, is obviously hotly debated right now. In fact, I'm moderating a panel tomorrow on that. But there's a lot of discussion now about it, but it's really happening in the traditional tethered desktop environment, correct? I mean, is that a correct assumption to make that it's not really happening yet in the mobile world, or is it starting to happen?
I think you're starting to see it happen. I think that by and large, though, information that is used for those purposes is either tied to demographics or information that's specific to your location. It's that kind of information. It's not. I think it's like the industry, very nascent and growing. But I think there's interest in being able to deliver that relevance on the device as well. And in many cases, and in our case, we know users. We have relationships with users both on the PC and on their mobile devices. They carry with them the same identity, the same account information. They carry that through their experience, and we're able to customize their experiences with the same preferences in both places. So we have that ability, that capability to do that.
Okay. Well, this is a good segue to the privacy issues, which I know everyone's thinking about. So I'm going to turn it now to Alyssa to talk about the privacy concerns and to talk particularly about the privacy issues that are raised with respect to mobile advertising as opposed to traditional web-based advertising.
So I think, on the one hand, you can think about advertising on the mobile web. I'm not really going to talk too much about text message-based advertising because it's a little bit of a different model. But I think when you think about mobile web advertising, at first blush, there's a lot that is very similar to advertising on desktop that's delivered to desktop PCs. To the extent that ad networks and other online companies are collecting data about individual users, answers, then it raises a privacy risk to the extent that there are profiles that get created. You know, all these issues that have come up in recent years about behavioral advertising, I think, apply equally to the mobile web as they do to the wireline web. And the same is true for the sort of lack of consumer awareness about which third parties are involved and noticing consumers about the fact that their behavior is being tracked as they go from site to site. It's essentially the same story whether you're browsing on the mobile web or whether you're browsing on the fixed web. But I think in some cases, the mobility adds a really unique flavor. And Anne actually already pointed to it a bit already when she said relevance is more important when you're on a mobile device. And part of that, I think, is because your mobile device is very personal. If you think about how you feel about your phone, right, it's for a lot of people, it's an extension of them. And it's certainly the case that they're not really necessarily sharing their device around with other people. So that's one key difference where when you think about the fixed internet, you might have shared terminals and a family computer, that sort of thing, not happening nearly as much with mobile devices. That means something for privacy. It means that a lot of the ad targeting can be more unique to you. It means that the identifiers that are associated with your device can probably be more easily tied to you, your phone number, your device ID. As far as those things are being collected, they're much more fixed and it's much easier to tie them back to the individual. But it also means that I think there's an opportunity to actually do better messaging, right? You know that user is the owner of the device, then you can probably reach out to them a little bit better and give them more accurate, more personalized privacy information because you're not having to deal with the shared environment. I think in terms of how companies are moving into this space, I think there's been a lot of attention and the spotlight has really been on the fixed internet. And so as ad networks move into the mobile space, they haven't really been under as much pressure as they have been on the traditional web. And so I just did a quick search in the last day or two looking for the privacy policy of one of the companies that I've heard of in the mobile ad network space more than any of the others. And the privacy policy governs its website. It doesn't govern any of the data that gets collected about the ads that it serves or places or the data that's collected about users on their devices, and I looked at for the privacy policy on my device, and I looked, on their mobile site and on their website, and I couldn't really find anything that talked about how they're collecting data about the ads that are served. And I know that they are because they report statistics about, how many ads are served on iPhones and how many are served on Android, and so on and so forth. So there's certainly companies out there that are collecting individualized data about advertising. But the maturity in terms of what the requirements are to protect privacy on those companies, I think, is not quite there yet. And I think if we see the kind of growth that that Anne was talking about earlier, then those are certainly developments that we at least would like to see.
Great. Does anyone else, because we are trying to cover three kind of big areas today, does anyone else on the panel want to say anything else about mobile advertising? I think this is now a good segue. The relevancy of the mobile or advertising on the mobile device is a good segue, I think, into location-based services, because that's many of the debate, or much of the debate, and many of the discussions about mobile advertising are related, I think, to the same kinds of debates you have about location-based services. So does anybody else have any other comments about mobile advertising before we segue to Lori to talk a little bit about location-based services?
I just always, especially when I'm in Washington, try to take the opportunity to remind folks how important advertising is to the growth of an innovation that's happening out in Silicon Valley and elsewhere. So, I mean, companies like Looped, I don't think we would exist, period, without the opportunity to monetize our business through advertising. I think it's probably pretty safe to say Yahoo wouldn't exist without advertising, or people would charge for it. So privacy is important. We need to balance privacy protection with users, with monetization and revenue opportunities. But, as if 2 million users get in an uproar about privacy, the privacy notice on Facebook, 200 million of them are probably going to get an uproar if Facebook starts charging tomorrow because it can't monetize that base with targeted advertising. So there's a lot at stake. We need to be very careful, particularly when folks are talking about adding legislation in this area. I think we need to encourage industry self-regulation and encourage companies that are doing it right to get out in front and talk about it. But, you know, keep our eye on the ball, because there's a lot of great innovation happening that's supported by advertising, and we're able to support these services for free to users for the most part with that revenue opportunity.
And actually, on that note, I'll just add that I know that last summer the Interactive Advertising Bureau issued a report about subsidizing mobile applications through ads, mm-hmm. and kind of the growth of that. And there's at least some speculation that the carriers, I don't know if this is going to happen for sure, but that the carriers eventually could end up subsidizing voice minutes based on mobile advertising. Mm-hmm. So I think to your point, you know, the argument is that, you know, it enables companies to offer richer content, richer applications at either a reduced price or for free. And I think you wanted to...
Yeah, I absolutely agree Yahoo wouldn't exist were it not for advertising, so I agree with Brian in that regard. But I think we do think of it a little bit differently. I personally don't like the term monetization because he's a business guy, and I guess I'm not, but clearly I'm not. But I think privacy is not something we're balancing against the monetization opportunities. It's really necessary to engender user trust, to have them use our services, to be there in the first place. We have very little currency except the trust of our users when they come to us. And with mobile sites, with any site, it's very easy to use another one. So we look at it as fundamental to building the relationship with the user, to make them come back, to make them feel comfortable coming back and sharing with us information about themselves that help us give them a relevant experience. Because if they don't trust us, they're going to go somewhere else. So I look at it as a very sort of compatible set of goals. It's not mutually exclusive, and it's not a balancing act where one thing means you're trading off something else. So that's just...
And I would just say, I think actually Looped is a really good example of how you can take a really novel idea and build a small business around it, exist in the advertising ecosystem, which supports so much fantastic content and innovation online, and do it in a really privacy-protected mm-hmm. manner. And that's mm-hmm. just, I mean, for CDT, that's exactly the kind of development that makes us smile, because it just shows that you know, it's if you think about it as balance or you don't think about it as balance, that, you know, it can all coexist at the same mm-hmm. time.
That's great. You're absolutely right. Looped is a great example of how it can work. So now I will go ahead and segue into location-based services, which is the next topic we're going to discuss today. And I'm going to turn it to Lori to talk about, just generally, I think the audience, you probably all are familiar with these services, but just generally kind of how these work, what types of applications are available today. And then, Lori, I know you have a presentation on one particular service that you are involved in.
Yeah, so there's a wide variety of location-based services, and we've heard it in all the speakers today have mentioned some of these services. A lot of them have to do with helping you find things that are near where you are right now, or finding people who are near where you are right now, or tracking your friends, or tracking your children, or your elderly parents, or your dog, or the objects that you can't keep track of, or whatever. There are all sorts of location-based services that we've heard about. At Carnegie Mellon, we've been looking specifically at location sharing services, sometimes known as social mobile, things like that. But basically, the services that allow you to provide your location to your friends or coworkers or family or whatnot. And we've been looking specifically at the privacy issues associated with them. So there are a variety of technologies that allow you to do this. They use a variety of techniques to detect location. Some of them use GPS in phones. Some of them use Wi-Fi in either laptops or phones. Some of them use cell tower triangulation. There's lots of ways you can do it, but all has very, very similar results, which is that you can find out where your device is located and, in turn, where the owner of the device is probably located. Once we know this information, we have the ability to share it, and some of these services allow you to set up friend lists of who you're going to share it with. Some of them are designed for employers to find out where their employees are. Some of these allow you to basically broadcast to anybody. Besides using it for finding your friends, you could also share the location with the service provider, who may then enhance the experience by providing you with information about where you are, or maybe providing that information to advertisers, as we've been talking about. Okay, so we've started looking at what sort of privacy features are available, and we found that most of the current location sharing services allow people to say, I'm turning the service on or off, you know, stop tracking me now, I don't want to be found right now. They also tend to allow you to say, these are people that I'd like to be able to see my location, and these are people that I don't want to see my location. Many of them also have a make me invisible feature, so you can very quickly, you know, press a button and say, wait, not now, stop sharing my location. Some of them have some location granularity, so you can say, well, right now I'd like to only people know that I'm somewhere in Washington, D.C., and then later today I can say, it's okay to disclose my exact location, what address I'm at. And so depending on which service, you may or may not have that ability. But we found, in general, most of the commercial services that are out there don't have extremely fine-grained controls over the privacy, and they don't let you find out who's been tracking your location. And this one is kind of interesting, because if you look in the privacy literature, there's a lot about transparency and sort of this reciprocal notion that, you know, I know about you and you know about me, and it's okay because we can both know the same things about each other. And yet we've seen very little in the social space of people being able to find out, you know, who's looking at me. And so
I'll just interject for a sec. So here what you're talking about is not the sort of the proactive allowing the application to let certain users track you, but the retroactive who track me.
Who actually did go and check my location. So who knows that I'm sitting here at this Hyatt right now? And so we wanted to find out whether this was something that, you know, the theory says that users would actually like to know this and it would make them feel more comfortable with the service. So we wanted to find out whether, in fact, in practice, this turns out to be the case. Just to give you some idea, my students took these screenshots. I think this is relatively recent. You can tell me if it's not. This is looped. You can see that it has some privacy settings, and I can decide here whether I want some friends to see me or nobody to see me. If you look at Google Latitude, there's their privacy button, and then when you click that, you can go to the location sharing settings, and here you can... you have the option of actually hiding your location or setting your location manually, which means that instead of having the system say where you really are, you can lie. Or it can detect your location and say where you really are. So this is sort of the white lie feature. Right. So we wanted to know, as I said before, whether does knowing who has viewed your mobile location affect the user's privacy concerns and their willingness to share? And so my students did a little study on this, which we just recently presented at the Computer Human Interaction Conference. So we built a prototype location sharing service with the awful name Locution, we deployed it. Yeah, I didn't like it. My students thought of that. We deployed it at Carnegie Mellon, and we built this only for laptops. We didn't actually build the mobile clients for it. And so basically, when your laptop was open and on the Wi-Fi network, we could track your location. And we hooked this into Facebook so that your Facebook friends could have an opportunity to see a map with your location. So it looks something like this. So here you can see the map and the little dot where this person was. And we indicate that that we found their laptop there. And then we have the Who Has Viewed Me button. And then we can go find out who attempted to view my location, and we see in red the people who attempted and the system denied it because I said I don't want, in this case, Aaron to see my location. And here, Beth, I said it was okay for her to see my location, and so I see that was allowed. We had an interface to set up rules, and in this particular prototype, the rules had to do with time of day. That we basically allowed people to say certain days of the week or certain time of day people could see my location, and other times of the day they couldn't. we conducted a user study to find out whether this would actually have an impact. And so the way the study worked is we had 56 participants who used Locution for 1 month. We paid them $20 to do this. We put roughly half of them in a condition where they could have the Who's Viewed Me feature, and half of them were in no feedback, which means they didn't have that feature. We took it off of their interface. And we had pre- and post-study surveys. So here you can see these are the people who had no Who's Viewed Me feature. That's disappeared. And the other group has the Who's Viewed Me feature. Okay. In this case, we did not allow them to specify specific people who could see the location. Instead, we did it based on their Facebook profile. So if their Facebook profile said that they could share things with, you know, anybody on Facebook or anybody in their network or any of their friends, that governed the set of people who could see their location. So our results were that we found that feedback, the Who's Viewed Me feature, actually did allay privacy concerns. And people were more willing to share their location when they were able to check and find out who had looked at their location. We asked people, we said, well, you realize that if you can find out who looked at you, then they also know that you looked at them. Is that okay? And of course, you know, people said, you always think it's better if people didn't know that I looked at them, but they were willing to make that trade-off. They said it was worth knowing who had looked at them, and they were willing to let other people know that they had looked. And we also found that people wanted more expressive rules than what we gave them. They wanted the ability to specify rules for particular individuals. They wanted time of day. They also wanted location. They wanted to be able to say things like, you can see my location when I'm on campus, or at a university, or in my office, but not when I'm at my house. They wanted that kind of ability. Just to see some of our before and after survey results, so we asked people how willing they would be to share the location with friends, acquaintances, and strangers. The green dots were before they used it, and the blue dots are a month later, and you can see that there's really no difference in their attitude before and after using it if they were in the no feedback condition. Those who were in the feedback condition had a big change, that after a month of using it and being able to see who was tracking them, they got a lot more comfortable with the idea of sharing their location. We can also see in terms of how many hours a day they were willing to show themselves. You can see that in the feedback condition, there were more hours per week with the red bars or the average hours per week that people were actually willing to make their location available than in the no feedback condition. Okay, so we took what we learned there and we developed a new system, this time with a little bit better name, Locuccino. So Locuccino, this time we've actually built it so it's available not only to Carnegie Mellon students, but actually the world. So if any of you are on Facebook, I encourage you to give it a try. And if you friend me and drop me a note, I'll friend you back and let you see my location. We've developed this first with laptop software, we've started working on a mobile phone client. Right now it only works on a Nokia N95, but we're working on other clients. Again, we've integrated it with Facebook, and we have another user study which is in progress right now. And so let me show you how this looks. So this is the Locuccino interface. Here you can see we have a list of friends, and I can search for them, and they show up on the map. We have a much more extensive rule editing interface now where we can actually specify who, when, and where to share my location. So who, when, where. And then we also have the mobile client, which allows me not to actually set my privacy preferences here, but to see my friends there. Now, let me see if the demo gods are with us. We can actually do a live demo. This is always a little risky, but we'll give it a shot. So you can see we're going on to Facebook, and we have Locuccino right here on Facebook, and it has found me at the appropriate place.
Wow.
There you go.
It's fast, too.
It is pretty fast. I can check some of my friends or students.
You're violating their privacy by putting their names on.
I did check with them. I know which ones will allow me to do this in a public forum. We'll try Aaron. Aaron specifically told me that if I were doing a demo, he wanted his location to be seen. And why is that?
He made sure to know exactly where he would be and be in a good place all day today.
So. Yeah, so he's actually in his office, interestingly enough, right there on campus at Carnegie Mellon.
His computer
is. He's not at the corner.
Or
this
is his computer. Right.
Lori, I don't want to. This is actually very, very interesting. And this is, thank you so much, because this is a great way to see the granularity of this particular application. I'm going to cut you off only because I'm getting kicked, you know, remotely here. but this is really interesting, and it raises, I think, all kinds of questions and issues. But, you know, one of the things that I think you probably would need with this kind of an application, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is you really probably need the ability to deliver the notice and the consent and the tools for people to make these choices. Really, it's probably better to do it or easier to do it in a desktop PC environment, right? So one of the things we want to talk about, too, is you know, kind of the differences between the desktop PC environment for notice and consent versus the mobile device environment and how much more difficult it can be to deliver effective notice and obtain effective consent, especially when you get to this level of granularity in the mobile device, on the mobile device. So I want to start with the other panelists, and I want to have everybody give me their kind of two-set opinion on, you know, how this all works and how it can work effectively. So I'll start with you, Anne.
Sure. So we try to provide notice and give users an opportunity to make a choice in a contextual way. So the first time that we connect to a cell tower or receive GPS information, we prompt the user to give us opt-in consent. And it's interesting because in certain environments, I have a BlackBerry. The BlackBerry device will actually ask me for opt-in consent as well, so I get a lot of different screens. But we do that any time that we receive location-based information and any time that we share information with an application or a third-party app, we ask for opt-in consent prior.
So it's going to pop up every single time?
It's going to show up the first time that we interact with that,
okay.
And it's going to show up the first time that we, or each and every time you download an application that wants to access any personal information or location information.
Okay, and so that's going to happen regardless of whether you're using your desktop PC or a mobile device.
In many cases, what we're talking about is in the mobile experience because we're not in the PC. I don't think that there's. I actually can't think top of mind if we actually have an example of where we're accessing GPS information on the PC.
Okay, I apologize. So we're talking here specifically about sharing.
Or accessing location information,
right.
Okay. So if you want to talk about notice and choice more generally,
we could spend a day on that too.
I know we can.
Okay, so that's helpful. And Brian?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we did a few years ago, I recall working with the Sprint Nextel Office of Privacy in particular as we were launching on Boost Mobile and then Sprint Nextel, is being really sensitive to this form factor and what consumers can and will digest on it in terms of notice and consent. And you just really have to pick your battles. You have to get used to, I know Twitter is like already cliche by now, but, you know, 140 characters, 150 characters, something like that is sort of the range you're dealing with, at least right now. It's a little easier on iPhones and BlackBerries and some of the smartphones. But, you know, making things very precise, picking your battles in terms of what you want to get across to the users. And that actually goes to the settings, too. And I found Lori's presentation very interesting. And we've always struggled with how many combinations of privacy settings to give our users, and especially, in the mobile environment. Mm-hmm. And generally, as a company, we err towards simpler is better, simpler is sort of a little bit more powerful. But we revisit that on a continuous basis. So I do think our sort of general philosophy is to keep things very simple, try to keep them concise, easy to get to, use icons and things like that when you can. But you really have to treat it almost as a product development and design process like anything else.
Absolutely. And Alyssa, do you have anything
Just one note on kind of notice and initial consent. I think it's easy to get hung up on that initial consent and, oh, I opted into this or that, and this actually came up a lot at the hearing on the Hill this morning. And I think especially in the mobile context, it's important to view notice and consent within a broader privacy framework. If all you iPhone users out there, you know, when an application wants to use your location on an iPhone, it asks you if that's okay, it asks you again, and after that, you cannot revoke that consent. And I've spoken with developers there, and that was on purpose. You can't revoke your consent once you once you've said it's okay to use that, for that application to use your location. You can clear all of your consents at once, but there's no granularity on a per application basis. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's just, it seems a little bit short-sighted, right? Because consent is not a one-time, right? Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing relationship with the service provider, and if we're talking about, you know, having more robust settings, the kind that Looped has, the kind that Lori just showed, right, there's a whole framework of privacy controls in there aside from that initial consent, and they're all, you know, just as important as that initial consent, if not more so. So I think it's really important to, there's a ton of work to be done in adapting to the form factor and making sure that people understand what they're agreeing to, but that's just the starting point, and it really goes on, you know, far beyond that initial, you know, tap of the screen.
And actually, I wanted to just put in a plug, because while Lori had the Fire Eagle thing up there, she didn't mention that it was a Yahoo.
Oh, nice.
It's us. We're Fire Eagle. One of the things we did with Fire Eagle, because it's a platform that literally broadcasts your location to other applications, and so we're very clear about the fact that you're making that information available. But we also, I mean, the default settings are set in a way that are very... I think very privacy friendly. It sends you a reminder about the fact that you're broadcasting your location. You have the ability to change the granularity of the broadcast, but you also have the ability, just by getting the email, to be able to go back and change that setting. In some cases, the default is that if you don't confirm the setting after you get the email, it'll automatically turn the broadcast off. You can change that, but we've actually set it in a way that's rather conservative, because we know that these are services that are very new to a lot of users. They may forget that they're broadcasting their location everywhere to everybody. So anyway, I just wanted to put in a little plug.
And Lori,
So I agree with most of what's been set up here. Let me just add another approach that some companies are taking, and that especially for services that are a hybrid between the desktop, laptop, and the mobile device, is to use the desktop interface for the configuration. Mm-hmm. So Facebook has their privacy settings that you do on the desktop device, but it also applies then to your mobile device. And so I think this is a good way that you can get beyond the limited screen space problem. And it's also a way that if a user wants to change their settings later, they can go back and find all of their settings and go back and change them. So I think that this is a useful approach. Another thing that we're looking at Carnegie Mellon is whether for these very detailed fine-grained controls, whether we can actually learn what the user wants. And so one of the things that we're doing is when you look at the Who's Viewed Me, if there's somebody who saw your location and you don't like it, you can click on the thumbs down and say, that was bad. And what we're hoping to develop is a system where the system can then kind of figure out why that was bad and suggest, oh, you should create a rule saying so-and-so can't see you, or people shouldn't be able to see you after 3 p.m. or whatever, and say, is that what you want? To kind of help the user so that they don't have to, like, go figure out all the controls to do
so
that.
So personalization in your privacy settings.
Personalization in your privacy settings. Fantastic. Yeah, so that's something we're looking at. And then the third point I want to make is that it would be helpful if there was more standardization as far as the options for privacy, mm-hmm. in all spaces, but especially in the mobile space, where, you know, if we knew that there were, you know, five different types of settings, and you could say, well, this service is a type 2 and this is a type 3 something, then we don't have to have a whole long policy on this little tiny screen.
I actually agree with that. I think one of the things that makes it really complex in the mobile space is that you're dealing with a variety of carriers, a variety of devices, yes, operating systems, applications, all of which will send different types of information, will make different types of information available to different providers. I mean, it's a very complex web they weave. So there could be a lot of standardization in a lot of places, I think.
Absolutely.
That would help.
And I know CTIA, for example, obviously has, you know, developed best practices in this area that have been, you know, in the works for a while and, you know, are revisited every so often, mm-hmm, because of that particular,
yeah,
issue. So, and Alyssa, I know you.
Yeah, I have my own plug.
Yes, you're working very hard on your own technology tools to help.
Right. So, I think you know, with respect to kind of what CTI has done on the policy side, CDT for a long time has worked on the technical standards side in this group that Heidi mentioned at the top, which is nicknamed GeoPriv. It's within the Internet Engineering Task Force, and I was actually kind of stunned when you gave your presentation, Lori, because you were talking about the who, the when, and the where, which are the, you know, the kinds of controls that users want. And GeoPriv actually provides a standardized way to express exactly those kinds of preferences. And so we've been really hoping for a long time that the GeoPriv set of standards can gain some broader adoption and be used for exactly what both you and Anne just talked about, which is having a standardized mechanism of expressing these preferences, regardless of whether you're using, a Facebook app or an iPhone or an Android or Fire Eagle or whatever part of the stack you're at and whatever kind of service you're using. This would just be a standardized way of expressing those user preferences and really giving users, empowering users to express those preferences and have the certainty that they get delivered to anyone down the line who receives their location.
Thank you. So we are running short on time. This has been a very interesting discussion. I think we could probably all sit here for another hour easily and continue talking about this stuff, but I want to leave at least a few minutes for audience questions. And then we do need to wrap up. And before I forget, I need to tell you that the closing panel, What Policy Framework, will begin at 4:30 in the main ballroom across the hall. And the cocktail hour starts, I believe, right after that. And that's also in the main hall. Right, Tim? Yep. In the foyer. So I will now turn it over to the audience just in case people have questions before we have to close up. Anybody?
Share that kind of data, or do you consider that in your privacy
framework?
Who would
framework? You like to answer the question? All of them, or any of them?
So a couple things in that regard. One thing when it comes to location is keep in mind that concept of where you are is not new. For example, I know where all of you are right now. You know where I am. If you use your credit card at Home Depot or an Affinity card, they're going to know you were there. People use their ATM cards all the time. Direct mailers have known where you live for decades. That's pretty common. What I think you're talking about is, for example, if Looped had an advertising relationship with Home Depot where we were giving coupons out or something like that, would we share with them where a specific person had gone, sort of a breadcrumb trail? And the answer is absolutely not. And part of what we're able to do, I think I talked about a little bit before, is act as a proxy between the user and the advertisers and agencies. So we can serve the ads to our users, and we already have that direct relationship with them. Now, again, if we serve a Home Depot coupon and somebody chooses to use that, then they'll have a direct relationship with Home Depot. But we won't need to share, and we won't share other information about that person that's sort of that's tied to their identity. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question? Yes.
That's probably more of an ISP-based kind of a insight, I would imagine, though, that you would have, not perhaps as a web publisher.
And Looped hopes to target advertising in similar ways in terms of what are other people in your social context doing, and you might very well, you're probably going to also like things your friends like or your family likes to do, right? And so we, though, already have a direct relationship with those users that I mentioned, so we can use that data to provide more and more relevant content, but also advertising.
Any other questions? Yes.
Do you all see a role for P3P?
We didn't even have time to get to that.
Can you have to define it first? Lori,
as you all know, is the person to answer this question.
The
author. Yes, yeah. The author of P3P.
P3P is the platform for privacy preferences, and it's a computer-readable format for website privacy policies. It is not dead, despite what people think. There are actually thousands of sites that use it, and Internet Explorer actually filters cookies by using it. Is there a role in mobile setting? I think there is. I think that P3P actually could be used in a mobile setting, and it could actually address some of the standardization issues that we talked about. P3P was not actually designed with this purpose specifically in mind, but it was designed to be extensible. And we had the foresight, perhaps, of leaving the hooks in so that when we figured out what we left out later, that we could add it in. And so I think if there was an industry consensus that they wanted to build on P3P, I think you could easily put those, use those hooks to put that what's needed in the P3P and make it work. But unless there's a consensus around it, it won't happen.
Okay, I think we can take one last question, and then I think we'll have to wrap it up. So you had a question, I think.
Oh, okay. The previous question before made me think about the analogy to the wired world. And, for example, if you have companies like Takoda are putting cookies on the desktop and then serving you ads based on your browsing habits, which they can do as long as they scrub your identity from the IP address, whatever, how would they do it? For the mobile world, I mean, your location is the different dimension, right? You can track you on the handset and the number. So the question about whether you can serve the data to third parties, would it be possible to configure something like that to feed it without identifying the person or the handset? And would that be something that would follow the track that online advertising has taken place on the desktop world?
So by and large, you know, we enable users to share information about themselves to third-party applications using various services that we have. But in the advertising context, it's generally in the best interest of those who are serving the ads not to share too much information, or no one's going to use them anymore to serve ads, I guess. So we do try to customize the ads based on what we know about the user and what kinds of interest they've exhibited to us. The different different carriers provide different identifiers to as part of that. So the concept of an IP address in the sort of wired world, in the mobile world, there are different types of identifiers, and they vary depending on the carrier, depending on the region. But we try to solve that problem to some extent. I mean, we don't. In many cases, when we're customizing ads, we're customizing them based on the identity the user has declared with us, and so we can recognize the user in a logged-in state across different devices if they have declared themselves, and we can use that information to better make the ads more relevant for them. But we also take steps to de-identify that data in our log files, and we've announced that data retention policy some time ago. The thing I think that makes us a little unique is that our data retention policy applies to all of our log files, including our mobile logs, which is not something I think anyone else is doing right now. So we're trying to provide users with good notice and meaningful choice on the front end of their experience, but we're also trying to take really strong steps on the back end to remove identifiable information as soon as we can from the records. So we're looking at it in that way.
I mean, it seems at least, and I want to hear what everyone else says too, but I think it sounds like it's at least theoretically possible to de-identify the information, because you could associate, you know, a unique ID, for example, with the mobile device. So instead of using, you know, the cell phone number or the SIM card number or whatever, it seems like it's at least theoretically possible. But how difficult it is a different issue, obviously.
Yeah, the location, so you don't care who the person is. You're just goes down Broadway today.
Right.
I mean, the one other aspect of that kind of ties together with identifiability and location is that, I mean, we all kind of have this sense that location information is a little bit different from other kinds of information, right? And there's a reason why, you know, people get up here and talk about how proactive they've been on privacy with respect to location, because it has this ability to show other people where you are, and they could follow you, and they could know that you went to the medical clinic or whatever. But the other key is that the government is extremely interested in location information. And with respect to identifiability, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, you know, me as the service provider, I can't directly identify that this ID, you know, and this location correlate to a particular person. But when the subpoena comes in order to, you know, triangulate between two different providers, you know, who was this person and where were they at that time, that data point may become identifiable. And so that's kind of another dimension of, I think, why location information does warrant heightened protection, because law enforcement has lots of good reasons to be interested, but at the same time has the ability to kind of draw those dots back together, even when they've been separated purposefully.
Also, yeah,
exactly. Anyway, I'm getting the hook. This is, you know, again, we could probably all talk about this forever. It's really interesting stuff. Thank you for being here, and thanks to the panelists for a great discussion.